Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good day, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today is the 14th of September. We will continue listen to Master Tenjin Chosen's program with the book Mind Trainings Like the Rays of Sun by Lam Kapel. And please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, welcome to the program, and I hope all is well with you. Today we start off with a speech from Shakespeare's Richard III, Act 5, Scene 1. Why then, All Souls' Day is my body's doomsday. This is the day that, in King Edward's time, I wished might fall on me when I was found false to his children or his wife's allies. This is the day wherein I wished to fall by the false faith of him I trusted most. This All Souls' Day to my fearful soul is a determined respite of my wrongs. That high all-seer that I dallied with hath turned my feigned prayer on my head and given in earnest what I begged in jest. Thus doth he force the swords of wicked men to turn their own points on their master's bosoms. Now Margaret's curse is fallen upon my head. When he, quoth she, shall split thy heart with sorrow, remember Margaret was a prophetess. Come, sirs, convey me to the block of shame. Wrong hath but wrong, and blame the due of blame. Yes, it's the final scene in which we see the Duke of Buckingham, the scene in which he's going to his death. If you know the play, you will know that the Duke had been the right-hand man of the Duke of Gloucester, who in due course, after many murders and devious machinations, became King Richard III. While serving his scheming and bloody master, the Duke of Buckingham had been promised the Earldom of Hereford. But when he tried to claim his prize, he was met by Richard's famous line, "I'm not in the giving vein today." And he realized that his head was very close to the chopping block. He fled and raised an army against Richard. But his soldiers were scattered by a great storm. He was captured, and in this scene he remembers how, not in all seriousness, he'd wish to die if he was false to the previous king's lineage, or if he put his full trust in someone not trustworthy. He recognizes that he had played games with God and lost, as the previous Queen Margaret had prophesied he would. Now, I introduce the program today with this snippet from Richard III as another example of the fifth point of the 6 points of suffering taught in the text that we've been discussing over the last few weeks of the program, the text Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun. The fifth point, as you might remember, is that in samsara we constantly change status. We might do everything to attain high status, but if we get there, we cannot stay but must certainly fall. Having low status, we will also not stay, but in due course will rise, and then only to fall again. The Duke of Buckingham was closest to the throne. He knew of and helped in all Richard's various schemes and also maneuvered the deaths of those Richard wanted out of the way. Whether he thought he was in some way exempt from Richard's fickleness, or whether he just enjoyed riding the bloody wave, is up to the director of the play to decide. But in the end, it all catches up with him. From moving within the hub of power, he fell into exile and then death. Now, of course, it's just a play, and we know that it's only based on what happened in the 15th century. And Shakespeare was not renowned for historical accuracy. Well, what playwright is? However, can we say that in a different context, the same thing cannot happen to us? We might work our butts off for a company and proceed steadily up the corporate ladder for a while, only to stall on some rung we think is way below our worth and effort. We're passed over for promotion, or even made redundant when least expecting it. And then we have to start all over again. Actually, that's the story of our learning and working life, isn't it? When we're a little child, we're the smallest body in the family and usually have to do whatever the grown-ups tell us to do. We grow up and attain a measure of autonomy. But when we go to school, being in the most junior class, we once again find ourselves in the lowest status. Slowly, as we go through the system, we become senior, only to fall to junior again when we go into intermediate school. Once again, we work ourselves up to the senior classes, but on graduation to secondary school, we become juniors, those with the least status once more. And so it goes on, through university and jobs. The continual change in status doesn't only apply within this life, but to successive lives as well. In one life, we might be like a god with every pleasure imaginable. The next, a starving, mange-stricken dog having to fight for every tiny scrap of food. Within lives and over lifetimes, we cannot be certain of holding on to any status at all. We rise only to fall, and then rise again, but once more to fall, and so it goes on. This is the fifth type of suffering. Then the sixth and final point in this set is that we have to go alone. But now, before we continue to discuss that, let's think about our motivation for participating in the program today. As usual, if you can, make it bodhicitta, the motivation to attain enlightenment, to be of greatest benefit not only to yourself, but to all beings everywhere. Otherwise, at least make it your own liberation from suffering, but nothing less than that. Certainly not some small motivation for just this life, which, with any benefit from the program, will soon be over. Thank you. If you think about it, no matter how intimate we want to be and try to be with other people, we are essentially alone. We go through the birth process alone. All our life, all our inner world is experienced by us alone. And finally, we have to go through the death process alone. Nobody can actually accompany us with any of our feelings, intentions, thoughts, impulses, and so on at all. We can tell others about what we're going through and derive some comfort from their understanding and empathy, even from their love. But the actual experience is always ours alone. How much do we strive for intimacy? The kind of intimacy in which we feel that we're always accompanied, that even if our experiences are not wholly shared, they are nearly wholly understood and may be enhanced. We're taught we should not be alone. We must seek a partner, at best a soulmate. We're taught that if we are alone, there's something wrong with us. On the website www.psychologytoday.com, Dr. Abigail Brenner writes about the importance of learning to be alone, but she starts off with this. For many of us, alone is a negative state of being. Society doesn't help with this either. Being alone often carries a social stigma, implying isolation, being on the outside. This perceived sense of aloneness seems to imply that being by oneself is not volitional, that it's not a choice we make, but rather an imposed state where a person is not socially engaged in the way that is somehow expected. Even further, it may imply that there's actually something wrong or defective with a person who remains alone. Social media gives us the impression, the illusion, that we are connected, even if it's only interacting with somebody's words. Clicking like is the abbreviated form of saying, "I hear you and I agree." Comments serve as conversation, as if we'd really interacted with that person in real time. Without this connection through devices that keep us informed to the minute, we may feel anxious that we will be alone and left out. But I believe that most of us really know in our heart of hearts that our constant focus on this kind of communication deprives us of having real human interaction. Even more importantly, this kind of communication may keep us from having meaningful communion with ourselves. Unlike being alone, loneliness often implies that you're looking for someone or something that you feel you need in order to feel secure and happy. For some, loneliness may be a chronic condition where your own company is never enough. where spending time with yourself may produce anxiety and sometimes worse symptoms such as panic attacks and depression. For many, the perceived solution to keep this fear away is to make sure that you're always in the company of another. Now, very recently, I met a young Indian man, 28 I think, staying in New Zealand, whose parents had come from India to visit him. On our first meeting, he told me that his parents were pressuring him to get married, although he was very unsure that's what he wanted to do. He was too young, still had too much to experience. But a couple of weeks later, the wedding date had been set. He told me he couldn't resist going with the flow. We're not offered the opportunity of learning to be alone even on that level. And yet perhaps when the novelty has worn off and going with the flow has become the river of mundanity, the young man might discover how alone he actually is, even with a wife by his side. And yet, if we can face it, if we like ourselves enough, there's something quite liberating in the realization that we are essentially alone, even though the facing of it may be scary. Dr. Brenner continues, "Being alone allows you to drop your social guard, thus giving you the freedom to be introspective, to think for yourself. You may be able to make better choices and decisions about who you are and what you want without outside influence. Often we're swayed by the thoughts, feelings, attitudes, beliefs, and behavior of those in our immediate sphere. Of course, you may ask others for their advice and opinions, but ultimately, consulting yourself and making up your own mind about what you want to do will lead you into the life that's best for you. More specifically, learning how to be alone may serve you well when it comes to knowing what you need and want in a relationship. Some individuals allow their partner to tell them what to feel, what to want, and to do, largely because that is what their partner wants and needs. Certain relationships even require this. So if you're too afraid to be alone and function on your own, you'll be selling yourself out, settling for a relationship, often not the healthiest and sometimes downright bad, that ensures that you're never alone. The bottom line is that you cannot possibly have a healthy relationship with others if you haven't learned to have a healthy relationship with yourself. People love to quote that line from Jerry Maguire, "You complete me." I know it's very romantic, but what does it really say? That we're not complete without another? Being alone allows you to access yourself as the complete person you already are. There doesn't have to be a pathological reason to explain your anxiety about being alone. Fear of being alone may be simply a function of never having learned to do it. It may never have been encouraged, and so the idea of it may feel alien and uncomfortable. Once you begin to venture into this territory, you may find that your comfort about being alone increases. You may actually crave that time you spend by yourself. Dr. Brenner then goes on to talk about how kids are often raised today. She says, many kids are hovered over and micromanaged. Very different from days gone by when children frequently had more time on their own alone and had to learn how to occupy themselves. While giving children a lot of opportunity to try various activities, we may be depriving them of this valuable time to learn how to be comfortable with themselves and to become resourceful. So alone time is a healthy thing to introduce early on to children who will carry the practice into their future lives. You may want to start small if being alone is new to you. Carve out time every week to be by yourself, an hour a day if you can. Take yourself solo to a movie or dinner. Venture to new places. Explore. Be adventurous. Build on the small to take bigger and bigger risks. If you were to remain alone as a lifestyle, assess what that might mean. Living without a partner, being responsible for yourself, your choices and decisions, traveling solo, managing your own finances, creating a full and complete life for yourself. Even though you may want to be in a relationship, can you be in a meaningful relationship with yourself if you had to? Take heart an example from the great masters. They embarked on solitary journeys to probe the depths of their being and to find answers in revelatory, transformative experiences. Spiritually, being alone may bring you closer to your inner being, allowing you to more readily access the creative and intuitive aspects of yourself. Give yourself the gift of your own time and energy. There's nothing more worth it. Now, this is advice from a professional. But here is something more personal that really explains the conundrum of finding oneself in solitude. On the website MinervaRising.com, in a piece titled Alone, Norma Hawthorne writes this beautiful essay. There's a wind blowing through the countryside here in southern Mexico. Red, orange, yellow, blue, white, purple and pink tissue paper flags flutter from the overhang that covers the patio of the casita where I live. Patterns of doves, flower baskets, sun, moon, stars and hearts repeat in positive-negative space. The flags are vestiges of New Year's celebration. I am alone. It's been this way for quite some time, even when I shared this space with him. But now, no one else lives here, only me. Usually, the quiet is a blessing. It reminds me of absence, emptiness, that something is missing, that I am once more finding my way. I hear the echoes of roosters and church bells, the wings of red-breasted birds, my footsteps on the earth-red concrete floor, the hum of the refrigerator. Each sound is amplified, emphasizing the singularity of my existence. This is not a bad thing, I'm learning. I've learnt that Buddhist traditions encourage one to be empty. Emptiness is a requisite to becoming full, they say. I think about what it will take to accept just the very act of being, without the need to accomplish or do much more during the day than rise, eat, sweep the floor, practice my balance by standing on one foot, my hands in prayerful meditation. But I'm inclined by nature to make or do something, like bake a cheesecake, knit a hat, plant a cactus, plan a workshop. For how long am I able to gaze at the ring of 9,000-foot mountains beyond my gate that cradle the sun's reflection in the outstretched palms of her shadows? Sometimes I falter, steal the chocolate bark from the freezer where I've hidden it from temptation, picking out the smallest bits as if no one else would notice. But who would? There is only me. This is when I am most lonely, like now, at night, when the wind whips, rustles the dried corn stalks, rattles chairs on the rooftop terrace, when the dogs and coyotes howl, when the sky is moonless and leads to infinity. When I moved into the casita last year and every sound startled me, my neighbor Frederico said, light a candle to settle the spirits. Do it once a month. Once a week is better. I know I've always been afraid, but I make myself pretend otherwise, urge myself forward. Each time, what I leave behind is familiar, predictable and comfortable. I know what I don't want to be, stuck, bored, controlled, settling for the mundane. I want to know the full reach of my capabilities, to allow myself to experiment. Once, I wanted to be the perfect child, believing that if I were so, my parents would love me, really love me. Now, the messiness of unpredictability is a blessing. The Mickey Mouse Club and American Bandstand taught me to be coyly sweet, dance well, and flutter my eyelashes. And every Saturday night date and lifelong marriage to the man of my dreams would be my reward. Then Gloria Steinem and Jane Fonda said, protest, go braless, call myself Ms., strive for an independent career. I straddled these two existences. My mother, shackled by her own fears, taught me the importance of making and keeping my own money. Don't depend on a man to provide, she said. Never demean yourself by having to ask. I learned from what she did not do herself. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose, cried Janis Joplin. For me, freedom's just another word for being released from fear, to live life differently, larger, more purposefully. To be released from fear is to acknowledge it exists within me. I get to be afraid of all the same feelings that tormented my mother. Not being good or smart or strong enough. Not having enough resources to sustain me. Not being able to make it in the world without a man. Believing otherwise is a lifetime practice. The cost of being alone is dear. My family and closest friends live in cities far away. In the lexicon of two failed marriages, I could call my relationship experiences limited successes. Would that be an honest assessment? I struggle to balance my need for autonomy with being partnered to a husband. I've heard other women say about themselves, "I'm not good marriage material." I wonder about that for me. What I miss is the companionship of my husband friend, the warmth and comfort of his body next to mine on a cold winter night, his wit and charm, the fire in his sky blue eyes that speak to me of passion, the sharing. These are idealized dreams and imaginings, mixed with a certain reality. Instead, I wrap myself in fleece. My companions are audio stories by Doris Lessing and Wallace Stegner, the poems of Sylvia Plath, and the few expats who live nearby and gather occasionally over a glass of red wine, an acceptable substitute. The slogans I live with solve me. One day at a time. Live and let live. Go for it anyway. Breathe and let go. I am of the age to know that each moment matters more than ever. In this moment of being alone, let me be filled with the joy of solitude and the gift of creativity. Who knows what will happen next? That is Norma Hawthorne. And on the website www.vipassana.com, we find a talk by the famous German Buddhist nun Aya Kemmer on why we should actually cultivate solitude. She says, "In the Sutta Nipata, we find a discourse by the Buddha entitled The Rhinoceros Horn, in which he compares the one horn of the rhinoceros with a sage's solitude. The Buddha praises being alone, and the refrain to every stanza of the sutta is, one should wander solitary as a rhinoceros horn. There are two kinds of solitude, that of the mind and that of the body. Everyone is familiar with solitude of the body. We go away and sit by ourselves in a room or cave and tell the people we are living with that we want to be left alone. People usually like that sort of solitude for short periods. If this aloneness is maintained, it is often due to people not being able to get along with others or being afraid of them because there isn't enough love in their own hearts. Often there may be a feeling of loneliness, which is detrimental to solitude. Loneliness is a negative state of mind in which one feels bereft of companionship. When one lives in a family or community, it is sometimes difficult to find physical solitude. It's not even very practical. But physical solitude is not the only kind of aloneness there is. Mental solitude is an important factor for practice. Unless one is able to arouse mental solitude in oneself, one will not be able to be introspective, to find out what changes in oneself are necessary. Mental solitude means first and foremost not to be dependent on others for approval, for companionable talk, for a relationship. It doesn't mean that one becomes unfriendly towards others, just that one is mentally independent. If another person is kind to us, well and good. If that isn't the case, well, that's fine too, and makes no difference. The horn of a rhinoceros is straight and solid and so strong that we can't bend it. Can our minds be like that? Mental solitude cuts out idle chatter, which is detrimental to spiritual growth. Talking about nothing at all, just letting off steam. When we let the steam go from the pot, we can't cook the food. Our practice can be likened to putting the heat on oneself. If we let off steam again and again, that inner process is stopped. It's much better to let the steam accumulate and find out what is cooking. That's the most important work we can do. She says that we should all take time to be physically alone every day and not worry about what other people think or say about us. She says, unless one can find a feeling of solidity in oneself from the center where there is no movement, one is always going to feel insecure. Nobody can be liked by everyone, not even the Buddha. Because we have defilements, we're always on the lookout for everybody else's pollutions. None of that matters. It's all totally unimportant. The only thing that is significant is to be mindful, totally attentive to each step on the way, to what one is doing, feeling, thinking. And it's so easy to forget this. There's always somebody with whom to talk or another cup of tea to be had. That's how the world lives, and the inhabitants are mostly unhappy. But the Buddha's path leads out of the world to independent happiness. Solitude in the mind means that one can be alone in the midst of a crowd. Even in a large and agitated crowd of people, one would still be able to operate from one's own center, giving out love and compassion, and not being influenced by what is happening around one. That can be called ideal solitude, and means one has removed oneself from the future and past, which is necessary in order to stand straight and alone. If one is attached to the future, then there's worry, and if one is hankering for the past, there is either desire or rejection. That is the constant chatter of the mind, not conducive to mental solitude. Solitude can only be fully experienced when there is inner peace. Otherwise, loneliness pushes one to try and remedy a feeling of emptiness and loss. Where is everybody? What can I do without some companionship? I must discuss my problems. Mindfulness is able to take care of all that because it has to arise in the present moment and has nothing to do with future and past. It keeps one totally occupied and saves one from making mistakes, which are natural to human beings. But the greater the mindfulness, the fewer the mistakes. Errors on the mundane level also have repercussions on the supermundane level, because they are due to a lack of mindfulness, which would not allow us to get past our self-inflicted dukkha. Dukkha here is suffering. We will try again and again to find someone who is to blame, or someone who can distract us. Ideal solitude arises when a person can be alone or with others and remain of one piece, not getting caught in someone else's difficulties. We may respond in an appropriate manner, but we are not affected. We all have our inner life, and we only get to know it well when the mind stops chattering and we can attend to our inner feelings. Once we have seen what is happening inside of us, we will want to change it. Only the fully enlightened one, the Arhat, has an inner life that needs no changing. Our inner stress and lack of peace push us outward to find someone who will remove a moment of dukkha. But only we ourselves can do it. Solitude may be physical, but that's not its main function. The solitary mind is one which can have profound and original thoughts. A dependent mind thinks in clichés, the way everybody else does, because it wants approval. Such a mind understands on a surface level, just like the world does, and cannot grasp the profundity and the depth of the Buddha's teaching. The solitary mind is at ease because it is unaffected. It's interesting that a mind at ease, which can stand on its own, also can memorize. Because such a mind is not filled with the desire to remove dukkha, it can remember without much trouble. This is one of its side benefits. The main value of a solitary mind is its imperturbability. It can't be shaken and will stand without support, just as a strong tree doesn't need a prop, because it's powerful in its own right. If the mind doesn't have enough vigor to stand on its own, it won't have the strength and determination to fulfill the Dharma. She says the solitary mind is strong because it knows how to stand still. That doesn't mean not associating with people at all, she says. That would lack loving kindness. A solitary mind is able to be alone and introspect and also be loving towards others. We need a solitary mind in meditation, so we need to practice it sometime during the day. The secluded mind has two attributes. One is mindfulness, full attention and clear comprehension, and the other is introspection and contemplation. Both of them bring the mind to unification. Only in togetherness lies strength. Unification brings power. And that's where we have to stop today. The 6 points say that going alone is suffering, but obviously that's for the ordinary worldly mind. Thanks for joining the program today, and let's get together again next week. Please dedicate to gaining enlightenment for all beings everywhere. Thanks and goodbye.